Yes, that's very welcome. And of course, the surprise in a way is that from a very, let's say, centrist perspective, the DA comes out fighting so hard against the value added tax. The core question then for how do you raise money is therefore avoided, and instead it's back to the budget cuts. And that's where I think, given a variety of other big problems, and at the end of USAID financing, especially of the AIDS program, about 20% of that now just disappears because Finance Minister Ganagwana just doesn't want to make up for it. Then we're looking at quite an unfortunate situation where we haven't really found yet the voice of the people most affected by the cuts and by VAT, that is just ordinary people. They don't have a voice. So yes, the DA has a louder voice, and they've got very eloquent people in there, and they can go to Washington and be part of the team when they need to, and then they can be disruptive to a budget process for the first time since the end of apartheid. And so this is a fluid situation, but unsatisfying to probably the majority of people in the country, because they will suffer, like 29,000 school teaching slots not being filled. Those sorts of cuts are going to be worse and worse.
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult either way you look at it. Despite the slightly positive idea of one minister not being able to be unilateral, I'll put it that way. It really is difficult. I mean, do you think there is enough pie for it to be sliced a lot more fairly than what it is going to be probably today?
Yeah, there's so many hidden subsidies. Even the International Monetary Fund, where they do sort of quite constructive work in saying here are the hidden subsidies that go especially to fossil fuel producers, the coal mines, but also the consumers of high-intensity electricity who are getting, for example, BHP Billiton, SAW 32 gets 7% of the grid, paying about 30 cents per kilowatt hour. That's about one-eighth what you and I pay. So those are the sorts of subsidies, when you say, slice that pie more fairly, that could be brought in. You could have a higher carbon tax. It's currently, in U.S. dollar terms, 38 cents. Europe, where we compete and probably losing because of tariffs, climate sanctions coming in next January, since ours is so low, 38 cents. Europe's is about $70 per ton. And those are the areas where I'd hoped we'd have seen some good constructive social debate. The climate catastrophe, especially Donald Trump amplifying it and dropping a $1 billion loan that his predecessor Biden had made for decarbonization. These are big, big parts of our budget. Or another big one, right? The SANDF, its mission in DRC. It was truncated by the defeat, really, against that M23 group. There was 5 billion rand allocated to that in the first budget, and by the time this one comes around for certification, it's obvious you don't need that sort of money for these adventures, which were, I think, entirely unjustified to try to, shore up the Eastern DRC's extractive industries, which are terribly, terribly exploitative. And in all those ways, you'd sort of say, make some major cuts, changes in the way spending occurs for activities that are justified, or in the sense of the carbon tax or a higher corporate tax. It's down to 27%. It was 52% in 1992 at the peak. And that means corporates have had a lot of time, 30 years, to invest in plant and equipment and build out, but they haven't. And they've had very, very low, in fact, below replacement costs, gross fixed capital formation, meaning those tax cuts from 52 to 27 didn't pay off. And I think a lot of people are saying, well, maybe corporates should pay higher tax. We're in the most unequal country in the world. Maybe rich should be, white people who benefited from apartheid, maybe a wealth tax. Now, Ganagwana is just not prone to doing those things. He used to be quite the Marxist when he was the leader of the biggest union, NUMSA, metal workers, but changed entirely. And I hoped that, not just the DA could chime in and say no VAT, but the rest of the society could have a voice on these crucial questions. Not to be this year.
Yeah, it is amazing how certain personalities change. Power is seductive, but certainly comes with a lot of, I suppose, compromises in the sense that once you're in power, your ideology is very difficult to follow.
Yes, and I think the other factor that we can't ever forget, because Gonangwana's predecessor, Tito Mboweni, had signed us up for a $4.3 billion IMF, International Monetary Fund loan. And this week we're also hearing about a new World Bank loan of $1.5 billion. The World Bank made a couple of other loans during COVID and subsequently. And what then, if you take their money, you kind of play their rules. And those are, as 100 different mentions of the two words fiscal consolidation in three reports that IMF puts on their website, but you know, basically told Gonangwana, cut that budget. And Gonangwana, I don't think he even wanted to. He was saying, I don't want to cut the budget. Let me find new ways to raise money. So I'm not just completely wrecking our state and shrinking state services and creating more service delivery protests. But, you know, he's not his own master, I think I'm saying, because once you start down that slope, and regrettably, he's doing it again this week with the loan. It's a loan for restructuring some SOEs, the Transnet, the Eskom, you know, the breakup of Eskom into different functional units, Transnet needing money, they say, for the PPP, that's called the public-private plundering system that they have. They've been doing a lot of that, you know, with the likes of that CSR, that China South Rail that gave us all those locomotives with the handoff to the Guptas. But somehow they keep this game in play. They need foreign loans, even though it's all local expenditures for the most part. And so that's one of our dilemmas. We're going into a debt trap, about $170 billion in foreign debt, over 40% of GDP. It's the same ratio that in 1985 led P.W. Botha to default, if you recall, way, way back. And that led to such eruptions with white business saying to the white apartheid managers in Pretoria, hey, this is now too much. We're financial sanctions hitting. They close the stock market, put on exchange controls. It may come to that if we're up at that level of a foreign debt crisis. Again, not talked about enough, in my view. Big dangers with this latest World Bank loan.
No, most certainly. And it looks as if any good things are going to be negatively offset by this loan mongering, which you've been so aptly describing here.
Yeah, there's the trade dilemma, because you're going to get quite a bit of the foreign revenues that you need to repay loans from exports to the U.S. You need to get quite a bit of, countervailing inflows, because the U.S., it looks like, even though there's some sort of behind-the-scenes deal, won't be allowing just as much the aluminium, steel, and perhaps the autos. It's hard to say. Parks Tau hasn't publicized what he put on offer in the Oval Office last month. But then comes next January. That's the carbon border adjustment mechanism I mentioned, which means we will lose European markets for those same big products, aluminium, steel, and soon petrochemicals, automobiles that are very high carbon intensive. You know, electricity that goes in is made from coal. Europeans, I think justly, are saying, well, that just would mean us outsourcing our emissions to a place like South Africa. It may seem like imperialism, maybe it is, but I think it's one of those times we, again, have to open up the debate and hopefully ask, you know, should that electricity be going to the huge exporters of aluminium, steel, petrochems, when so many people need it much more affordably here in South Africa for small business, labor-intensive industry, and households. So I hope those are the next set of debates you'll help us get going in the society.
Do you think enough people realize exactly what's going on? Because in government and economics is inevitably today what drives government, and if you're not informed, you can put yourself up the creek very, very quickly. Do you think there's enough understanding in political circles to know exactly where we're heading or even what we're doing?
No, I mean, another example of exactly this, big questions that the society really should be answering, is where the interest rate may continue to stay very high because they're changing inflation targeting. And this is part of what the Reserve Bank does to, again, obfuscate the power relations and who wins and loses, because the interest rate has been one of the highest in the world. I think we're fourth highest among countries issuing 10-year bonds, along with Pakistan and Brazil and Russia. The very, very high rates of real interest that are paid to foreign investors. And if we could just have tighter exchange controls and not worry so much about that 3 to 6% range. They now want to drop it to 3 to 4% range inflation. That's their target, which is why they keep the rate so high, to suppress demand. So we're not spending so much, right? This is the theory behind these high rates. That would be, again, you know, wonderful if the society could debate that. But I think the technocrats, the bureaucrats, the money mandarins, they just don't want us to have those sort of democratic debates. That's why the Reserve Bank is owned by banks. It's considered an independent institution that has its own way of doing things without a monetary policy committee, without any real attempt to democratize, to explain to Parliament, to go to the people and say, hey, are we doing the right thing? Is this the right trade-off? Who's getting rich? And, of course, it's those who've already got money are the ones who like the high interest rates, because that's their rates of return on their financial assets. So I hope that's the sort of thing we can all chip in and put our opinions about how high the interest rates are, where the budget's being spent, what the tax burden looks like. So, keep these discussions going.